From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A camera scans a crowded street at a protest or a parade, and almost instantly, law enforcement can identify most adults who were there. Well, facial recognition technology is getting good enough to do that, and nearly a quarter of state and local law enforcement agencies in the United States already use facial recognition technology in some capacity. Well, San Francisco just became the first major city to ban its police and local government from using it. So how do we find the right balance between surveillance and civil liberties? This hour on Point, law enforcement and facial recognition technology. And you can join us. Do the police where you live use facial recognition technology? Do you want them to? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today from San Francisco is Tricia Thadani, City Hall reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Tricia, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about this ban that recently went through in San Francisco. What's the scope of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's really two aspects to this ordinance that recently passed. So the first is what you just mentioned, is that it would ban city departments from using facial recognition altogether. So that means no matter what, they can't acquire it in the future. It's important to note that currently the San Francisco Police Department says that they don't use it, but, you know, as I just said, they won't be able to use it in the future now. And then the second part of this ordinance that hasn't gotten as much attention is that it would force all city departments to disclose what surveillance technology it is currently using. So that's anything from license plate readers to body cameras to bag tracking devices at the airport. And the idea behind that is that the ordinance, is that the public has a right to know what surveillance technologies are currently being used on them.
Okay, and so they would have to disclose all of those surveillance technologies publicly, or to the city council, or to whom?
Yeah, so it would, by going through the Board of Supervisors, it would be public, but okay. it would be for the Board of Supervisors to review what they're currently using and then decide basically if they're comfortable enough to continue letting these city departments continue using that technology as well.
Interesting. So there hasn't been that kind of accounting before. We might find out some pretty interesting things that are being used for surveillance
Definitely.
In San Francisco.
Yeah, right. Looking forward to seeing those lists.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the facial recognition ban for a moment here, because I want to listen to some tape of Aaron Peskin. He's the San Francisco city supervisor. And he told CBS affiliate KPIX-SF on Tuesday of this week that cities need to work on really outlining or fleshing out their facial recognition policies. Here's what he said.
Not ready for prime time. I mean, this is a technology that misidentified 28 members of the United States Congress and has led to some very dangerous situations. Every city agency that has surveillance technology need to develop a use policy that will go to the Board of Supervisors for approval.
So, Tricia Thadani, tell us a little bit more about the specific concerns that San Francisco city leaders had that led to this ban.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's similar to what Peskin said, where, you know, you hear a lot of arguments about how facial recognition is still this emerging technology that has been rife with mistakes. And even though our city departments say that they don't currently use it, Peskin and his supporters say it's important to keep this emerging technology, while it's still very much imperfect, out of the hands of law enforcement, just in case it could misidentify suspects.
Okay. Well, there was some pushback, though, right? Because we spoke a little bit with Joel Engardio. He's the vice president of Stop mm-hmm. Crime SF, a grassroots organization there that opposed this ban. And here's what he told us about why they oppose the ban on facial recognition technology.
There are times when facial recognition technology, you know, it can help locate missing children. It can help find people with dementia. You know, so these are areas where it would be helpful to use. Let's not use it if it's not working, but let's not ban it forever, because the technology will improve, and maybe when used responsibly, we could actually benefit from it.
So, Tricia, was this a concern that also San Francisco law enforcement had, that the city was taking off the table a potential technology that could actually better their policing?
Yeah, so you heard from the Police Officers Association, and they have said that even though the tech isn't 100% perfect, it has been successful in providing leads to crimes elsewhere in the country. And you also heard this from, so the one supervisor who had actually voted against this ordinance was Supervisor Catherine Stephanie. And she had made the argument, she had also agreed, you know, it's not perfect. But why are we putting a complete ban on it? Why don't we just create like a framework around the use of the technology, which could be maybe not the sole thing that law enforcement uses to help identify suspects, but definitely a supplement to help them.
Interesting. But we should be clear, though. I mean, from your reporting, Tricia, I see that the San Francisco airport and the port of San Francisco, mm-hmm. since they're not exclusively run by local authorities, right, that they can mm-hmm. still go forward and use this facial recognition technology. And the ban also leaves room, obviously, for private organizations and businesses to use it. So what's stopping San Francisco law enforcement from just getting information from them?
Right. Because if San Francisco, so they could, they very much, but it would be if the private, you know, the private person who has that technology, they have to basically offer it to the San Francisco Police Department. And then the department wouldn't be able to acquire the technology because obviously they'd have to go to the Board of Supervisors to be able to use it on their own. But if it's offered to them, then they can use it.
Okay. Well, Tricia Thadani, City Hall reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, speaking with us today from San Francisco, of course. Tricia, thank you so much for helping get us started.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. We want to move now to Hillsborough, Oregon, and talk to someone there, a member of local law enforcement that's been using facial recognition technology. Chris Adzema joins us. He's Senior Information Systems Analyst at the Washington County Sheriff's Office in Oregon. And Washington County was the first law enforcement agency in the country to use Recognition. That's Amazon's facial recognition tool. Chris Adzema, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, tell us a story about how the Hillsborough Police Department the Washington County Sheriff's Office, how they decided to use Amazon's facial recognition technology.
Well, it was about 2 years ago when recognition from Amazon was first announced. We had already had an idea that because we were getting so many emails asking if we could identify somebody from either internally or from the local police departments, if there were to be a way to search those faces against the booking photos that we already had in our system, because we noticed that most of the time those identifications came from our jail deputies who had seen those individuals before. So we were trying to figure out a way to use the photos that were coming in and search. And the recognition provided that ability. And so moving forward with that, we tested it out and liked the results we saw and moved forward with a fully implemented system.
Okay. How easy was it to adopt recognition?
Well, Amazon makes it pretty easy to, if you know how to code, to create your own system around it. So for me, it was pretty easy. It took about a month to get up and running.
Yeah, and it doesn't cost very much, just from reporting that I'm seeing.
Yeah, initial setup was about $700, and we spend between $6 and $15 a month.
So $700 to set it up, and then about the cost of a couple of lattes a month to keep it going.
Yeah, and that doesn't include my salary for maintaining the system, but yes.
Okay. And how often do Washington County Sheriff offices, deputies, or law enforcement, how often do they use it? Every day?
Yeah, about every day. In 2018, we did 1,004 searches.
1,004. So, yeah, so that on average, three a day or
three
so.
Or four times a day, yeah.
Okay, and what difference has it made in the policing?
Well, we have been able to identify some criminals, mostly in property crimes, such as porch theft, shoplifting, things like that. But it's been relatively all of the deputies who've used it have talked, said it's a good tool for them to have, and they like having it around.
Okay. And just walk me through how they're using it. I mean, where do the pictures come from that they're feeding into Amazon's facial, into recognition?
Typically, they come from the victims, whether or not it's a private person at the private home who has a surveillance camera or a doorbell camera. They'll give us either the video or a screenshot of that person. Same with local businesses who have surveillance cameras. They'll give us the video or the screenshot of the incident where the crime was committed, and we'll take a screenshot of that video, put it into our system for the search and review the results.
Okay. And the results that come out, though, I'm reading here that in the system that you built internally for the sheriff's office, that that law enforcement officers get 5 possible suspects back as a result, but they don't get the information on the percentage confidence that recognition has of the accuracy of the results?
Yeah, we don't give that to them because it didn't tend to be important to them. They weren't utilizing that information at all. They were looking at the pictures. They were not looking at the percentages. And so we decluttered the user interface, essentially.
Okay, but I'm wondering what officers or even residents in Washington County think about that. I mean, that you know, there's a difference between the system returning a 99% confidence on a picture versus a 90% confidence, isn't there?
No, there's not, actually. We found in our testing that something that returned a 99% wasn't the person. You can look at the picture side by side and say, that's definitely not that person. And some results that returned 73% were indeed that person. So while, yes, the system's telling us it's a 99%, we as humans are looking at that and saying it's not the case. So what we didn't want to do is get a situation where somebody saw 99% and that somehow biased their decision-making. So we wanted them to make the human decision by looking at the pictures themselves.
Okay, but I'm just... Okay, well, so hang on here, Chris Adzema, because we do have to take a quick break, but this is really fascinating. So stand by. Chris Adzema is Senior Information Systems Analyst at the Washington County Sheriff's Office in Hillsboro, Oregon, and we are talking about facial recognition technology and its use in law enforcement, how it can lead to better policing, and how to balance that against the interests of civil liberties. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about law enforcement and the increasing use of facial recognition technology and how to use this tool to better policing while also protecting civil liberties. We're talking about it this week because San Francisco became the first American city to ban the use of facial recognition tech at the local level. But we're joined today by Chris Adzema. He's with us from Hillsboro, Oregon. He's the Senior Information Systems Analyst at Washington County, the Washington County Sheriff's Office, which was the first law enforcement agency in the country to begin using recognition. That's Amazon's facial recognition tool. And Chris Adzema, can you tell me a little bit more about how officers using recognition, how it's changed the way, they do their investigations? Has it allowed them to use tools or methods that weren't available to them before?
Well, I think mostly it's sped up the investigations because, as I said previously, it usually rely on an email going out to everybody and waiting for a response. But now they don't have to wait for that response in some cases, and they can move forward with the investigation more rapidly, possibly being able to catch the person with the property that they stole still in their possession. And so that's the biggest change that it's made to their investigations and their process.
I see. So how much of the unreliability of the system, though, are officers accounting for? Because as you were saying earlier, sometimes it might return a picture or a result that's only 73% confident, but it's the person. It's the suspect. I mean, I'm also seeing here that, for example, the system responded to a uploaded mugshot of O.J. Simpson and returned the photo of a white man with a beard as the potential suspect.
Exactly, and that's why this is the first step in their investigation, okay. Not the last one. This isn't the identification step. This isn't the one where we say that's definitely the guy. This is the first step. They put the picture in, and they get a list of people, and then they go on, and before they even think about talking to any of those people, they do investigation. Well, first off, they look at the picture side by side to verify that it's even possible that it's that person. And if they believe that that person does indeed look like the person in the mugshot, they'll do some more investigation whether or not it's, in some cases, they'll go onto Facebook. There was an example of a gentleman who cut his hand in the commission of a crime. His face returned in a facial recognition result set. The investigator went to Facebook for the name of the person returned, and turns out that the guy on Facebook was complaining about a cut on his hand.
Uh-huh.
And so that's an example of how they would go through further investigating before even thinking about going down a path to investigate a specific person.
So it's a tool in the toolkit. I hear what you're saying. Are officers required to put in their police reports that they've used the technology in the course of their investigation?
They're not required to by policy, but most of them typically do if that's what assisted them in getting the result.
Okay. And in terms of, I'm just wondering sort of the scope and the scale again. So when an officer does a traffic stop, say, do they routinely in Washington County now take a picture of the person they've done a stop on and run a search on, an Amazon recognition search on them?
No, that's not something that they do. I do personally review every single search that goes through the system, and I've never seen an example of a common traffic stop being used. The only time I've seen it used in a traffic situation was a car was reported stolen, that car was pulled over, and the person behind the wheel refused to identify themselves, and then it was used in that case. But common traffic stop is nowhere near the level of stealing a vehicle. So
okay.
There's the threshold. In our policy, you're required to have reasonable suspicion that they committed a crime, and traffic violations are not a crime, so they wouldn't rise to the level of being able to use facial recognition.
But at least in that one case you're referring to, all it took was the person refusing to identify themselves, and that was enough to...
Well, it was actually them being behind the wheel of a stolen vehicle.
Okay. Okay.
That was the crime.
Got it. Okay, good. And I'm wondering what pushback or concerns have you heard from members of, or residents in Washington County about the sheriff's office using this technology?
The biggest pushbacks and concerns we've heard were mostly around not understanding how we use the technology, either the concern that we were using it for mass surveillance or real-time surveillance, which we don't, have never done, and as per our policy, can never do. We can do real-time surveillance in the case of a threat to, like a significant threat to life, like a terrorist attack or school shooting, something like that, but that's never happened yet and happens very infrequently in our county. Another concern they brought up was the use of other databases like the DMV photos, things like that, which we don't use and won't ever use either. So those were the major concerns that came up, and we were able to discuss that with them. We went to a couple of different meetings of local groups, talked to them about that, and helped dissuade those concerns.
Okay. Well, Chris Adzema, Senior Information Systems Analyst at the Washington County Sheriff's Office in Hillsboro, Oregon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Claire Garvey. She's joining us from Washington. She's senior associate at the Center on Privacy and Technology at the Georgetown Law Center, co-author of The Perpetual Lineup, Unregulated Police Face Recognition in America. And we have links to multiple reports that Claire has authored on this issue at onpointradio.org. Claire Garvey, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So you just heard Chris Adzema in Hillsboro, Oregon, say this is a great policing tool that's helped them speed up investigations in Washington County. So what's the problem?
What we're finding is that in the absence of regulation and legislation around how law enforcement agencies can use it, while this may be isolated incidents, we're finding that there is the possibility of misuse, and this misuse does happen. We just recently, as you mentioned, put out two new reports, one of which finds that law enforcement agencies submit all manner of photos or non-photos to their face recognition systems, expecting valuable leads back. An example from the Washington County Sheriff's Office is that they put forensic sketches into their face recognition mm-hmm. program. This is something that is permitted under their existing system. This is not an accurate representation necessarily of the person they're looking for. In New York, we see that the NYPD conducts what they call celebrity comparisons, putting in a photo of a celebrity doppelganger when the face recognition system fails to identify the person in the investigative photo that they have. So, and then by consequence, we did hear that this is considered an investigative lead, a first step in an investigation. And yet what we're also finding is that law enforcement agencies rely almost entirely on face recognition matches to make arrests. In one incident in New York, where the policy clearly states that face recognition is an investigative lead only, the investigating officer sent the face recognition possible match over to the witness in the case, just that single photo, not a photo array or a lineup, asked the witness, is this the person you saw commit the crime? And the witness texted back, yes. This is almost exclusively relying on the results of a face recognition match to make an identification.
Huh. So there's a lot to dig into here, but let me just back up for a moment and ask you, at the top of the hour, we heard a tape from San Francisco of the concerns about the accuracy of the technology. It has gotten a lot better, but where does it still fall short, and why is that a concern?
The face recognition algorithms are getting more accurate, but it doesn't matter how accurate a system gets if investigating officers are putting in garbage leads, if you will, the wrong people, for example, in the celebrity comparison example, or drawings of faces as opposed to photographs of faces. We can't really expect the systems to produce accurate or reliable results.
Well, we also then have studies that show that if you are a dark-skinned woman, the more melanin you have in your skin, the more likely the images are to be misidentified.
That's right. Studies continue to show that face recognition performs differently depending on the person being searched for, depending on that person's age, race, and gender. And for African-American communities, this is particularly problematic because these communities are disproportionately subject to surveillance. San Diego County has acknowledged that they use license plate readers and face recognition technology between 1.5 and 2.5 times more on communities of color than their proportion of the San Diego population would suggest. People of color are also disproportionately enrolled in face recognition databases because of their over-enrollment in mugshot databases. And then add on top of that, that these systems, depending on how they're set up, may misidentify darker skin folks more often than anyone else. And you all of a sudden have risky technology that may, whose risks may be disproportionately borne by African Americans.
Huh. And it seems to me that it is challenging for members of the public to find out if and how this technology is being used in their local law enforcement departments. Because Chris Adsma, I asked him about how often or are officers required to say in their police reports that they used it. And he said they're not required to, but generally they do. But I'm seeing here in the Washington Post that did an extensive story about the Washington County Sheriff's Office. The Post says that in public record searches, they could only turn up 9 case reports in which facial recognition was mentioned. So, I mean, is there a transparency problem here?
There's a huge transparency problem here. I have been sending records requests to hundreds of agencies over the last few years. It's incredibly challenging to get information. And here's a good example. Back in 2016, the NYPD told us they had no responsive records related to their face recognition program which we knew existed and had existed since 2011. We have since sued them and are in ongoing litigation against them for these records, and they have produced 2,700 pages so far. So there's a huge barrier to getting information even when that information exists. And that extends not just to the public, but to courts and defense attorneys as well. We're seeing that face recognition, because law enforcement agencies consider it a lead, they don't necessarily put it in arrest warrant applications or turn it over to defense attorneys under discovery, which means that it has been almost completely opaque to the court system, even though it is leading to arrests.
But Claire Garvey, though, to push back on that, I can't imagine law enforcement officials love to put this stuff out in the public, because their argument might be, one of their arguments might be, why should we tell, you know, criminal elements what our investigative tools are and how we're tracking them down?
Well, as a practical matter, face recognition, the way face recognition operates is part of the public record already. And the way to evade capture, if you will, if the argument is we can't tell the public about face recognition because criminals might use that information to evade detection, the answer is put on a ski mask. Face recognition operates off of video cameras, which have historically been, their use by police has historically been public. The other answer to that is that it should be up to communities to decide whether this very powerful technology is used on them. They are subject to policing. It should be up to them to decide whether a face recognition, which does carry civil rights, civil liberties, and privacy risks, whether that's a risk that they're willing to take, and whether the benefits outweigh those risks. And what we've seen with San Francisco is that that's a community taking a close look at the face recognition technology systems and deciding that the risks far outweigh the benefits, such that a ban is appropriate.
Well, let's go to some callers here. Let's go to James, who's calling from New Orleans. James, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it. So here in New Orleans, we actually found out that there was a facial recognition system, a crime system that the previous administration had deployed throughout the city. I don't know if it was a federal partnership or not, but due to a Freedom of Information Act, that's how we found out that the system was deployed throughout the city. And because of some great reporting here on the ground, a lot of New Orleanians found out about it. And the system is still in place. I know that the city right now has deployed crime cameras throughout the parish that continuously monitors activity, and hopefully it serves as a crime deterrent as much as possible. But it was a little startling to see that because of some good reporting and some advocates that are, you know, pressing our government to make sure that, you know, they're actually keeping our government accountable, that we were able to find out about this system. Yeah. So to my knowledge, the system is still in place. And, you know, New Orleans, unfortunately, does have some crime issues. But, you know, as long as there's accountability in the system and it's the government's transparent about it, I don't see any issue with it, just as long as, you know, it doesn't take a Freedom of Information Act to ensure that we know what's actually going on here.
Well, James, thank you so much for your call. Let's see if we can sneak another call in here before we have to take a break. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that if there's any discrepancy at all, like the previous interviewee said, with the whole 99%, sometimes it returned a false positive, and the 75% facial match was a person. I think if there's any discrepancy like that, we should sideline this technology until we have more accuracy in it.
Got it. Well, Mark, but let me just ask you quickly, though. I mean, Chris Adzema from Hillsborough, Oregon, the guest you're referring to, he said it's just one tool in a law enforcement officer's entire toolkit. And so does that give you a little comfort? Like, they're not just, according to Chris, they're not just using, like, one quick return from the computer and going out and deciding someone's guilty.
Right. Of course not. But I just, when you're dealing with people's potential freedom and stuff like that, I just like to err more on the side of caution until we have absolute assurance from a technology when it's used this way, especially with the whole accountability and it's not being necessarily shown in police reports. I think that we should sideline it a little, or at least scale it back and have more oversight on it until we have more accuracy in the technology.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for your call. Claire Garvey, we've just got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break, and the word accountability came up in both of those calls here. Where's the one of the first places you might build in that accountability?
I think it starts with the legislation. Again, San Francisco has given us a model and a successful model showing us that there is public will to put the brakes on this technology. There are other accountability mechanisms like audits and public reporting that police departments themselves can do proactively, even in the absence of legislation. I would love to see this happen.
Well, Claire Garvey at the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law Center. Hang on here for just a second. We are talking about the increasing use of facial recognition technology and law enforcement in the United States and how to balance the needs for better policing with civil liberties. We'll be back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about law enforcement and the increasing use of facial recognition technology. San Francisco this week became the first American city to ban the use of facial recognition technology amongst its local law enforcement, but it is being used in other places. Of course, not just in the United States, but globally as well. In London, in the UK, police are using cameras to scan passersby and match their faces to watch lists. An East London man very recently did not want his image captured, so he covered his face as he walked by the cameras. Local London police demanded that he uncover his face, and when he argued with them, they fined him about £90 or about $115 for disorderly behavior. Here he is talking to the BBC about the incident earlier this week.
He said he got facial recognition. So I walked past like that, it's a cold day as well. Because I've done that, the police officers asked me to come to him, so I've got me back up. I said to him, off, basically. I said, I don't want my face shown on anything. If I want to cover my face, I'll cover my face. It's not for them to tell me not to cover my face.
That's in London. Claire Garvey, a senior associate at the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law Center. Let me ask you, thus far in our conversation, we've been talking about law enforcement using facial recognition technology in the United States, largely in context of crimes that have already been committed. Have we seen or are we seeing any jurisdictions using it like they have here in London, just scanning people, passing by, going about their business on the street to see if they match any suspects on watch lists?
Yes, we see a great degree of interest by U.S. law enforcement agencies to have face surveillance capabilities. In fact, we recently discovered that both Chicago and Detroit have very powerful mass face surveillance systems that if they're not in operation today, they have been purchased and they are all set up to be able to perform this exact function. And they're not alone in this. The Orlando Police Department is piloting a program also with Amazon recognition that we heard about earlier. The U.S. Secret Service is piloting a program around the White House. And New York's MTA has also been piloting a program that would operate on faces of drivers coming into and out of Manhattan on the bridges and tunnels.
But again, I'm thinking from a law enforcement standpoint, this is such a potentially important and powerful tool because, you know, for example, in our editorial meeting this morning, we were talking about, do you remember that terrible terrorist bombing in Brussels at the airport a couple of years ago? And one of the suspects wasn't tracked down for days. And you can imagine, I mean, every minute after a major attack like that is absolutely crucial in an investigation and to prevent perhaps follow-up attacks. So if you have technology that's out there on the streets of these sensitive areas that you just talked about, that after an incident could very quickly examine faces of people walking by and potentially identify suspects, isn't that an important law enforcement tool?
It's true. Face recognition is a tool, and it's a very powerful one. But what we're seeing is that it carries very, very serious risks that law enforcement agencies aren't contemplating and aren't mitigating prior to acquiring this technology or piloting the technology. Chicago doesn't have a policy as far as we're aware. Their 2013 policy says policies will be developed. That's as far as they've gotten in determining how and when they would use their face surveillance capabilities. Similarly, Orlando has withheld discussion of developing a policy until after they decide whether or not to use it. So we're seeing law enforcement agencies put the cart before the horse, if you will, at the risk of our privacy rights, our First Amendment rights. This technology carries very serious risks, and it threatens manifestly changing the nature of our public spaces and how we choose to go about our business.
Right.
We need to see a comprehensive discussion and recognition of that before we even begin to think about applying this technology.
Technology racing ahead of legal structures seems to be the story of our times. But, you know, another example of where this could go, I was reading about how in China, the technology there is so good. And of course, the legal barrier is much, much lower, that they can do things like scan in real time the faces of people, 50,000 people at a concert, and find folks who authorities want to question and even arrest them right at the end of the concert. That can happen now. And it's apparently happening in China. Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Todd, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Todd, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a public defender in Baltimore, so I represent indigent people who are often stopped by the police and who have had their Fourth Amendment rights, which is the right to be free from illegal stops and seizures. They've had those rights violated. So I see this technology is kind of playing into it where we're already under a Department of Justice investigation here, a consent decree. And so when you hand this over to the police without 100% certainty, we've already documented that there are tons of people being stopped for no reason whatsoever who aren't committing any criminal activity. So when you stop the wrong person for no reason, you're just furthering these Fourth Amendment violations. This is just another tool that the police will use. And they may be saying that they're not going to go and make an arrest based on it, but it's those initial encounters of completely innocent citizens that are extremely problematic.
Hmm. Todd, thank you for your call. Claire Garvey, would you like to respond to that?
Just to agree that it's incredibly problematic. What we're hearing from public defenders is they're not being told when and how face recognition is being used in the cases that they take on. They're not being told whether it was used to identify their client. And here's the problem. Under federal law, prosecutors are required to turn over evidence that would suggest somebody else did the crime or the person they're charging did not do the crime. Face recognition produces that evidence. We heard from Chris Adsma about the fact that somebody who was identified at a 99% level may not have been the person they land up charging, or that the face recognition system produces 5 possible matches. This is the algorithm essentially saying, we think any one of these 5 people may have been the person committing the crime in that photo. That information is not being turned over to the defense to review. The courts are not seeing this and evaluating how reliable this evidence is. And yet, it's required by law to be turned over. So this is a fundamental failure of due process when it comes to the use of face recognition.
Well, let's go to Ron, who's calling from Columbia, Missouri. Ron, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
If I served 8 years in the Army and been overseas in a war zone, but if you have nothing to worry about and you're not a criminal, then what's the point? I have no problem with facial recognition of them using it to find terrorists, whether it's a kidnapper or whatever the case may be. If somebody has a criminal background and it identifies them, that's just better policing, in my opinion.
Ron, thank you so much for your call. Claire Garvey, Ron's probably not the only person who feels this way, that the innocent have nothing to worry about.
Sure. So 2 things on that. One is that increasingly, law enforcement can scan not just people with criminal histories, but law-abiding citizens, because they have access to driver's license face recognition systems in at least 32 states now. This is over half of all American adults being enrolled in a face recognition database because they chose to get a driver's license. The other point is that we live in a country with the Fourth Amendment, which does not say if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Mm-hmm. Just don't do anything wrong and your privacy rights will be respected. That is not the way the Fourth Amendment is worded. We are a very privacy-protective country. This is something that we have fought long and hard to protect. Face recognition also risks our First Amendment rights, our rights to peaceably assemble. Imagine being in a protest, and it's a particularly contentious protest, and you are probably violating various ordinances like blocking a public roadway or exceeding a noise ordinance, and yet our country relies so heavily on the ability for us to participate in that free speech, in that free association.
Yeah.
Face surveillance risks this.
Yeah.
It risks having people change their behavior because of this fear of being surveilled.
Well, Claire, we have a minute and a half left, and there's one more area that I definitely want to touch upon with you, because I am still taken by how Chris Adzema in Oregon told us that it cost them only $700 to set up the Amazon recognition system, and it cost them $7 to $8 a month, right? I mean, and we have got Microsoft also in this world, lots of tech, you know, several tech companies here. The low cost to entry is shocking. It's really surprising. But who owns all the information that Washington County is pumping into the recognition system? Does Amazon, or when they use a Microsoft system, do they own it? I mean, what role do the companies themselves need to be playing here?
So in most law enforcement systems, the algorithm, if you will, the system is built by a private company, but then transmitted over to the law enforcement agency. All the information, the criminal history information, the photographs are retained within the control of the law enforcement agency. There are some exceptions to that. There's a company called Vigilant Solutions that have gone ahead and built their own face recognition database based on mugshots that they've scraped from, I believe that they've scraped from public websites. But for the vast majority of these systems, the information is still retained by the agency.
Interesting. The Microsoft CEO, Satya Nadella, though, has said in the past that while the tech companies can self-regulate, they also welcome, he does, any regulation that helps, in his words, the marketplace not be a race to the bottom. Absolutely fascinating. Claire Garvey, Senior Associate at the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law Center and co-author of The Perpetual Lineup, Unregulated Police Face Recognition in America. We've got links to Claire's work at onpointradio.org. Claire Garvey, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, in a moment, actress Glenn Close's advice for the class of 2019. This is On Point. Well, it is indeed commencement season, and congratulations to the class of 2019. Over the next several weeks, we'll listen to excerpts from some of the best graduation speeches given this year. And so today we'll hear from award-winning actress Glenn Close. She addressed graduates at her alma mater, the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. She did that on Saturday. Glenn Close celebrated the freedom to be a critical thinker, a freedom that she cherishes because from the age of 7 to 22, Glenn Close lived with the Moral Rearmament Army, a movement she's described as a cult. Her parents joined the MRA when she was a child, and Glenn Close left at age 22 and told the William & Mary grads that college was the first time in her life where she enjoyed the liberty to think for herself.
The crucial ability to question and assess from a dispassionate, objective point of view whatever beliefs or tribes you eventually choose to espouse. It doesn't come to me naturally. I had been raised to be a total believer, to not question. But for me, coming into this ideas-rich community, having had all my beliefs and behaviors dictated to me from the age of 7, it was vital that I learn how to question. You have a much harder time of it now than I ever had. When I graduated, there was no internet. You wrote your papers on typewriters. There was no Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. I didn't have the added enormous pressure of social media against which to develop as an adult. I think my mind would have exploded. I didn't have that insistent, seductive noise in my pocket and at my fingertips. Even now, I try to question, but how do I maintain my individuality without thinking that I am somehow not relevant, not hip enough, rich enough, not posting enough, that I don't have enough followers? What each of you have and what each of you must believe in from this day forward is your inherent uniqueness, your singular point of view. No one looks out into the world through your eyes. Your perspective is unique. It's important, and it counts. Try not to compare it to anyone else. Accept it. Believe in it. Nurture it. Stay fiercely, joyously connected to the friends you have made here, those who you love and trust. You will have each other's backs for the rest of your lives. I wish I were funny like Robin Williams. Don't we all? I wish I could make you laugh so hard you'd fall off your chairs. I'm not wise. I've had the lucky chance to learn by doing. After being in my profession for 45 years, though, I have learned a few things that I want to briefly share with you today. In order to inhabit a character, I have had to find where we share a common humanity. I can't do characters justice if I'm judging them. I have to find a way to love them. The exploration to each character I played has made me a more tolerant and empathetic human being. I have had to literally imagine myself in someone else's shoes, looking out of someone else's eyes. I urge you to learn how to do that. You can with practice. Start by being curious about the whys of someone's behavior. Before you judge someone, before you write them off, take the time to put yourself in their shoes and see how it feels.
Glenn Close, talking about freedom, critical thinking, and empathy to graduates of her alma mater, the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. We've got a transcript and a video of her address, all at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.